So let's get digital. We've heard a lot about the world as we're at a turning point in history, an inflection point, maybe a world between orders. So where do revolutionary technologies fit into that story? Well, we are in a digital age, and technology is both an enabler and a disruptor. And increasingly, technology is one of the defining forces shaping our geopolitical competition and the exercise of power. When we talk about artificial intelligence, cyber, quantum technologies, cryptocurrencies, they're reshaping the levers of power in the international system. And this is what states are increasingly using to pursue their objectives. Stephanie Beck talked about the future of war, and the future of war is upon us. And the most likely scenario for Canada going forward for the foreseeable future is a persistent state of hybrid warfare. So beneath the threshold conflict, we're no longer talking about three domains, air, sea, land. We're also talking about cyber and space as being an integral part of that. So it has been spoken already that national security, economic security are intertwined. Well, we throw in foreign policy into that, technology, critical infrastructure, supply chains, and especially an issue close to my own heart, information integrity. These are no longer issues adjacent to foreign and defense policy. They are integral to it. So what does this mean for Canadian foreign policy, and how should Canada be positioning itself? And how do we do this in the skimpy hour that Michael Small gave us for this panel, which is has the most complex issues and the shortest amount of time? Well, you invite brainiacs. So I have three just stellar panelists here who are leading experts in Canada on the intersection between technology and foreign policy. So that's Dr. Anne Fitzgerald, Wizard of Oz here, who's the director of the Vasily School of International Affairs, Raphael Rohinsky, who's the CEO of SecDev Group, and Vass Bendar, the managing director of the Canadian Shield Institute. So we are going to start with just two kind of structured conversations around key themes just to set the stage. And we'll start with you, Anne Fitzgerald. So what are revolutionary technologies? What do they mean for understanding of geopolitical competition? And what does it mean for Canadian foreign policy? You get the easy question.
Thanks very much, Jennifer, and good afternoon to everybody in the audience. It's a real privilege and pleasure to address such an august and esteemed audience today, and thank you to SIPS and all the partner organizations. I would be there in person, but we've had a number of convocations this week, including today. So I'm here with the students, but delighted to be coming in virtually. So I think I'll break down that question a little bit, and I will start by saying, answering the question, what makes a technology revolutionary? And I feel that it alters how power is generated, distributed, and exercised across states, across markets, and across institutions and societies. It's also economically transformative. This issue dates back to the advent of the printing press, right, in 1474, where it was disruptive. We were talking about rupture and disruption then, where the equilibrium went like this. And we had to restore the equilibrium. So we had to learn about copyright. We had to learn about plagiarism and all sorts of other policy orientations that went with that disruption. But the disruption is quite large here. And I would describe it as bringing in a new general purpose technology using different factors of economic productivity. So we've gone from labor and physical capital to data and algorithms and large language models, AI, et cetera. So there's an invisible economy, an intangibles economy at work, which is affecting trade, foreign policy, security policy, everything. And although I come to this debate through a lens of defense and national security studies, the dual usage nature of this general purpose infrastructure, which will empower, is empowering, and will empower every sector of society, even the most traditional sectors of society, makes me able to comment, hopefully, a little bit wider than just defense. So, what's that new general purpose technology? I like describing it as a car. It's easy for me to remember, it's easy for me to describe. The driver is artificial intelligence and the tools and the clouds and everything that comes with that. The engine is computational power, so compute crunches the data. The gas going into the car, the electrons, are the data, because you need data for artificial intelligence, you need data for everything. It is the most strategic asset of any organization today. And the shell that goes around the car that protects it are the protections. And I would break those protections down into three parts. The first would be intellectual property, the second would be cybersecurity, and the third would be standards. And I want to come back to standards and the whole mission of standard setting in a moment. The second issue I would break down from your question is how do revolutionary technologies alter power? Well, they create advantage and strategic advantage and leverage. They create new foundations of power in doing this. And it hasn't gone unnoticed that the United States, for example, has pulled out of 66 international conventions, treaties, and agreements in the last 12 months, but it has not pulled out of three. And this is very interesting. Those three include the International Telecommunications Union, the International Electrotechnical Commission, and the International Organization of Standardization, the ISO. What this means is that power is now at the plumbing level, at the technical level, not at the strategic level and all about values and norms anymore. It's about the technical level. And trying to set the technical norms and standards which best support the economies and the industrial strategies of what at the moment are two geopolitical powers. So it's all about plugging into one industrial strategy or the other and having rule setters and having rule takers. And we are trying to be grafted into continuing to be a rule taker. So there's new rules, a rentier economy that results where you have a landlord and you have tenants, and the tenants pay all the costs, and we have to accept the rules that benefit others. And that's an area in my mind that we can take this middle power conversation and discourse to. Middle powers can actually turn the rhetoric and discussion into action by setting standards that are aligned with our democratic principles, instead of this blurred distinction between public and private power that we see being exercised elsewhere in the world. So, we accept certain narratives coming out of that new power structure at the technical level as well. In many parts of Canada, there is a narrative that has been accepted that we are in trade deficit, surplus in certain sectors with the United States. And if you think about how much the US monetizes Canadian data and then sells our data back to us through many different challenges and also sells the insights from our data back to us, then you would easily calculate a large trade deficit across all sectors, especially the net present value of that trade. So, what does this mean for foreign policy? Your last question, Jennifer. It means technology is entering diplomacy, trade, defense, and economic policy. We've moved from eras of capitalism that have spanned the agrarian economy to industry and industrial policy, the whole, Marx principles. And now we are in an economy where 92% of the wealth of the S&P 500 accounts for intangible assets. So what it means is that we have a data-driven age where competition centers on knowledge and technology and infrastructure and governance. And for Canada, that's an important issue because if knowledge and the ability to capture wealth dictates whether or not we are going to achieve prosperity, then we have to protect that knowledge with the protections that I mentioned, keeping a strong knowledge system, higher education, and creating pathways for the innovations that come from that knowledge. So I'll stop there.
That's a fantastic scene setter and also a good segue into the conversation I'd like to have with Vass. When we talk about foreign policy, you can't listen to a speech from the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, Evan Solomon, without the theme of sovereignty coming up. And yet there's no one sector, I don't think, where Canada is more dependent than in the technology sector. Given all of our technology platforms are controlled by the US, what does sovereignty mean in the context of technology, and what does it mean specifically with data and digital sovereignty and the implications for Canadian foreign policy?
Okay, I'm going to do my best. Sovereignty now. One of my girlfriends pronounces sovereignty, sovereignty, and I think that's important to remind ourselves of that as a concept, it is kind of sensational, meaningful, aspirational, and dangerously vague, kind of all at the same time. Personally, running a think tank that focuses on it, I'm terrified I'm going to spell it wrong one day. I think technology means a lot in this regard, right? One, we are more aware of and awake to the weaponized or the risk of weaponized interdependence. But these interdependencies predated the Trump administration. And of course, they're just perhaps a little bit more willing to emphasize and sort of extract from them. In terms of the opportunities for Canada, I mean, one, I think an area where we've been weak in this moment, and I think the word moment, like rupture, is one we can't, use enough, is thinking about really deeply about the alternatives that we want to build and own. So, yes, I think it's very smart and appropriate for Canada to be building more sovereign compute capacity. Finally, we're seeing, more of a vision for how we're going to govern data with our, privacy law coming forward. But do we want to continue to rent the suite of Microsoft Office tools for the next 11 years? My understanding is we're in like a 9 or 11 year contract, right? Just that realization of the infrastructures that we rely on. And accept that we'll be using in perpetuity. Other jurisdictions are turning to open source models or building alternatives that they will own. It was just reported that a jurisdiction, I don't know, I'm forgetting it, maybe I'm nervous, but is building, trying to build an alternative to Palantir, right?
France.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you're here. I'm so happy to be with you. we could do the whole panel if you could just chime in with citations. That would be a good, we could take it on the road. It was reported that the EU and the UK are exploring, alternative payment systems. Are we even having that conversation in Canada, or are we cool with Microsoft and Visa's duopoly, right? Outside of the Trump administration, if we didn't have the situation that we're in, we wouldn't have even, I think, entertained or been as open to these conversations. So it's kind of up there. I put where, what capacity, but also what alternatives do we want to build and do we want to own? And the second opportunity that I think we're starting to see, I mean, how intriguing was it that, a few days before introducing and sort of pitching Canada on a new privacy and data law, the Prime Minister was signaling, hey, we're super EU-like here. That's Canada. Well, is our legislative environment going to be EU-like when it approaches these things? Like, that's a very interesting question, but I think some of the opportunity that starts to come forward is the kind of policy coordination you're kind of already tacitly seeing. We can call it policymaking all we want, but more often than not, when it comes to Canada, we echo. We're policy takers. We love a jurisdictional scan, and we'd love to know what everyone else is doing. And I think part of the middle power and opportunity is working in concert and working together. You know, this domino effect, and I'm not necessarily endorsing the policy, but of social media bans, you know, in the interim, at least for young people, is something that's happening very quickly. So what other areas of coordination might we see that can be interpreted as, you know, new governance regimes for technology writ large, but also the technology that's come to dominate our everyday lives? Maybe those are two things I'll put in the window that we can continue to pick up again later. Thank you.
Great. So we've talked about technology and power dynamics. We've talked about technology and sovereignty. And I'd like to shift the gears a little bit because I think we need to also talk about technology and funding and financing. Raf, one of the game changers that hasn't been raised today is about cryptocurrencies. And that is changing the way in which we support democracies, also as a development component. And wonder if you could take us through how cryptocurrency has become a game changer for foreign policy.
Yeah, I will, but I'm going to step back just for a second and sort of engage in the discussion that you had with Anne and with the Vass here, because I think it's important to recognize that, okay, we're talking about Canadian foreign policy today, but we're situated in a historical moment. And in physics, there's this interesting concept known as a three-body problem, where you have three orbital or three bodies that orbit around each other, which cause patterns which are hard to predict. And historically, that's where we are. And that three-body problem for us right now is made up of three things: demographics, technology, and geopolitics. Demographics, why? I look across this room here and I don't see anyone under the age of 35. Guess what?
No, there are students.
There are students.
Also,
Okay, sorry.
the ambassador alumni.
The ambassador, okay.
It's like legit.
Okay. Reality is this: two-thirds of the world's population is under the age of 35. Vast majority of them are digital natives, meaning they have never known a world that has existed without a cell phone or access to the internet. Their relationship with their fellow humans, with what is possible as far as agency goes, human agency, is very different than those of you sitting in this room who have been cultivated in a rules-based institutional order where your agency was defined as much by your position within an organization as it was anything else. That demographic mostly sits in the emerging world, where technology has served to fundamentally change their ability to exercise their agency, whether that's to change things politically or change things economically, and that will continue to drive things forward. That intersects with technologies now that have become truly transformative in our era. AI is one, quantum is the next one. Third one is actually cryptocurrencies, and they've acted in different kinds of ways. AI is important to recognize because it is the last, if you last, the latest of the great changes, transformational revolutions that we had in economics. We had the agrarian revolution. We had the industrial revolution, which effectively mechanized human tasks. We have AI, which is actually reducing cognitive tasks. But unlike these previous revolutions that we had, where there was a diversity, if you like, of options available, AI and quantum is mostly centered around two countries that control 90% of both the talent and the resources, and that is the US and China. And that's a reality that we live in. These transformative technologies occur at the same time as we've had the largest decline in an international rules-based order, which is principally important to be able to negotiate how these technologies impact populations in terms of equity, access, and ability to act. And that's a great problem. Now, why cryptocurrency? Who here knows who is the richest Canadian? Anyone? It's not Jim Bell, silly. I'm sorry, Vass.
Is it the Ethereum guy?
Nope. Changpeng Zhao. Anybody ever heard of him? He is the head of Binance, which happens to be the largest cryptocurrency company in the world. which over the last 5 years has transacted $145 trillion in terms of trade. Okay? 41%. He was in Canada until we deregulated his company out of Canada in 2023. So he's the richest Canadian, but his company isn't actually located here. To give you a sense of what cryptocurrency currently represents, here it's a speculative tool. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's 13% of trade, rising by 52% every year. Trade which is no longer off-ramping in US dollars. Trade which is off-ramping in yuan. Why? Because the balance of trade in sub-Saharan Africa is where? China. Why has that occurred? It's occurred for two reasons. One, cryptocurrencies are easy to use. All you need is a cell phone. You don't need a bank. But it's also a consequence of our foreign policy. Targeted sanctions have led to banks de-risking. And de-risking has basically meant leaving large swathes of the population in the emerging world unbanked. They've turned to the simplest tool they had, which is cryptocurrency, to replace that. In Southeast Asia, where we have a problem with scam farms, about $68 billion was transacted in cryptocurrencies last year. To give you a sense of that, that's about 43% of the total combined GDP of Myanmar, Laos, and Cambodia put together. The cryptocurrency economy is no longer just part of the digital economy, it's becoming the real economy. And this is maybe the symptomatic point here, that while we think about technological transitions as being something that occurs here, where we hold the reins of it, both in terms of access to the know-how, access to the capital, the reality is, in the last 20 years, this has become greatly democratized. What that means is, and this is an interesting story. Last year in Bangladesh, we ran a hackathon funded by Global Affairs Canada just before the elections, where we were asking young Bangladeshis to come up with solutions using blockchain artificial intelligence to help information integrity in advance of the elections. We had 200 teams that applied within 60 days of the election. The 20 teams that were actually selected would have won any hackathon that was done here. But here was the eye-opening moment for me. The technology that was being used by these teams was identical to that which would have been used by students at the University of Waterloo. Their knowledge of how to use those technologies was exactly the same level. In other words, that digital divide no longer existed. But here was the difference. Students at the University of Waterloo are a solution looking for a problem. They're bright, but they don't quite know what they want to solve. In Bangladesh, the students knew exactly what problem they wanted to solve and were able to put the technology to make it happen. That's the great transition. That's the great canvas against which much of what we discuss here happens. And the challenge is that from a foreign policy point of view, we haven't recognized that Canada's strength lies in being able to harness our leadership in technology to build new relationships that are different than the old economy that we keep talking about that we need to preserve with the United States. It's an opportunity space that remains unexploited, but one which probably, because we're talking about the commanding heights of the economy for the next century, is more worthwhile talking about than the auto industry in Ontario or agriculture in Saskatchewan. Thanks.
Pick up that strain about democracy and hackathons. We did feature here at the University of Ottawa Taiwan's experience in protecting its general elections from an onslaught of industrialized disinformation from China, and how that how they basically used a volunteer hackathon culture to do that work in real time to bunk and protect democracy. So I'm going to turn it back to Vass for a moment on that theme about information integrity, disinformation, the distortion of AI, and how that fits into that sovereignty agenda.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think we're seeing something with how Google is collapsing search that plays into everything here, right? So the Google summaries are revolutionizing the economics of advertising and of search, but we're still speaking about search and sort of accessing information online as if it's just a few extra clicks away. We're all operating on the presumption that information that we want, information that we once saw, is out there in that very kind of X-Files way, like the truth is out there. And I think it's worth asking what happens when it's just not anymore because of those vectors of control, because of not quite cybersecurity, but intentionally thwarting that. I think of the recent example in May for any readers, any subscribers to Nate Silver's 538 blog, right? That was Disney making a particular decision, but just boom, it's gone. It's not even going to be archived. I hope that Canada can start thinking more carefully and more intentionally about our collective history and how we come to know ourselves. When we have that cultural conversation, it's all sort of pent up right now in, should streamers pay into Canadian cultural funds? How do we have the authority? Are we making this a compelling case to sort of import our broadcasting regime? We're not speaking about what is otherwise seen as something that's reserved for sort of librarians, or you mentioned volunteers, right? Volunteers. Is the solution, just a Wayback Machine for Canada? No, not quite. But Internet Archive Canada, my understanding is that they are localizing information in Canada and sort of building that version so we can start to have that history. And we also need to preserve, more and more communication is happening in a way that's never documented at all. Disappearing stories, right? It's designed to sort of have an impermanence, and information has always had that as a quality, but not quite in the way of our digital histories. There's AI generated historians. There's people who perform as historians online with YouTube channels as if they are relaying authentic information, intentionally skewing our public record of what history is, right? Other times sort of imputing like importing like a computational version of a person into a historic scene itself, which is more surreal and strange. But I think also that material needs to be captured, documented, understood, so that we can understand ourselves, but also understand what's happening in terms of the new forms this kind of manipulation can take. Sorry, I gave you kind of a long and winding answer, and it probably makes it seem like I'm on the computer like all the time scrolling, but I swear I'm not. I think it's been a little bit harder for us to think about this. So we have an access to information problem. We have a pollution problem online. More and more content is being created that's synthetic, that's not real, that's being trained, that's being then being used to train itself into models. We see search itself, like any digital system with its negative externalities, being gamed by material that is, then put on Reddit or, again, trying to game that algorithm and game that system. How do we build that vernacular and language to not neutralize or perfect, but what do we want to build, and what is the role of the state in curating and supporting the maintenance of our knowledge economy?
You raised that issue about, the need for strong narratives, because we are in an active information warfare now and cognitive warfare. And those are things that not are necessarily seen by our population, but the way of combating it really depends on us being able to protect, to project a common narrative, which has been a challenge for Canada. It'll be instrumental to how we position ourselves in this cognitive space and how we do cognitive forechecking in this space. But I want to bring it back to Anne on the theme of how information distortion, how technology is changing warfare more generally, including conventional warfare. We've seen in our world of polycrises a series of asymmetrical wars. What does that mean for foreign policy when that's also combined with what we've been talking about in terms of distortions in the information space and cognitive warfare?
Thanks, Jennifer. I think the cognitive and information warfare and psychological warfare issues are hugely important. And really, something that hasn't been mentioned is the importance of a strong media ecosystem and governance authority over that media ecosystem. I think we all live in our individual information bubbles. And, you know, I have go-tos in my bubble. You all have go-tos in your bubble, Politico, The Economist, you know, Globe and Mail, et cetera, whatever we have time for or not. And you can think about the bubbles that are represented in Canada here. So the key bubbles that are mandated with that task or actors within the bubbles need to be strong and well-resourced and well-governed. I think one thing I'll say is the increased nature of autonomous warfare. You mentioned the five domains. We've gone from land, sea, and air to land, sea, and air, cyber, and space. We can't afford capability, strong capability across all those domains. Very few countries can. But we need to prepare for that autonomy better in the future. And I would commend, if you haven't read it already, Prime Minister Meloni's speech to Parliament a couple of weeks ago. She was the first European leader to really speak out and say, following events like the breaking up of the France, Germany, and Spain, I think, coalition around the purchase of the fighter aircraft, she was the one that said, do we need a whole different approach? And this is something I've been really thinking about and working on reimagining defense because of the importance of autonomy across those domains and how humans in the defense realm are moving from direct operators to supervisors of machine-enabled systems. And this relates back to the knowledge economy that we're living in as well, and the machine-based knowledge economy. War is also becoming data-driven. It's the most strategically important asset for states and businesses and organizations. It is in conflict and war as well. So sensing, collecting data, the low-level satellite communications, we saw the role that they played and have been playing in Ukraine, but the processing of data, the speed of decision-making, who can see, understand, decide, and act the fastest. We see war becoming much more cheap and much more scalable. So the low-cost drones can destroy tanks, ships, advanced air defense systems, and automation brings economy of scale, right? And so it lowers cost and, oddly enough, you know, increases affordability in some communities and societies. We see increasingly targets that concern infrastructure. And I study insurgency and now algorithmic insurgency, and key infrastructure is under attack. And I think that's why defense has to be reimagined as well, because grids have to be protected. Undersea cables have to be protected. Any critical infrastructure that connects with our most strategic asset, data centers, quantum computing centers. So, you know, there's broader than the traditional national defense culture. And then war increasingly blurs domains. War is persistent these days. It doesn't come with boundaries between peace time and wartime, between civilians and the military. That's a blurred distinction now as well, between public and private. Look at Palantir. Look at what Elon Musk brought for the low-level satellite jamming in Ukraine, and also domestic and international. So I would say for foreign policy, it becomes more about technology and the new general purpose infrastructure. Middle powers matter differently in this space. And it's been interesting watching the defense ministers and the discussions going on in Brussels at the moment. Alliances also will evolve in this space. NATO, as it confronts issues concerning data sharing, Like, what does autonomy mean for a collective security organization? And governance becomes crucial. And I'll go back to that standard setting comment that I made, that middle powers need to be rule makers, not just rule takers. And we need to come together. When we do, we're very powerful. We saw that over Greenland. And we can do that over standards concerning the use and application of technologies.
Raph, I know you're itching to get in. I hope also in your interventions around this issue, you can also bring us into how this agenda has affected intelligence as well at a time when there's a rapidly evolving threatscape. It's never been more important to understand the world. AI has accelerated all this. So please weigh in on decision making and warfare, but also please talk to us about the effects on intelligence as well.
Sure, since we're the last panel of the last day, I'll try to make it entertaining as well. Does anybody know why the year 2023 matters or its significance? Anyone?
Give
Bueller?
a hint.
2023 is the last year that you could be certain that a piece of data was not synthetically created by AI.
Oh, yeah.
Hugely, hugely important. We tend to think of the contest over AI as being just algorithms, better models. That's true to a point. Capable models give you better reasoning. They can be fast. Vast amount of money are being put into it. And I think this is something that we just want to emphasize here. This is truly the battle over the commanding heights of the economy. If you take together all of the major publicly funded programs of the US of the last century, the Manhattan Project, the Apollo Project, rural electrification, the creation of the interstate highway system, bring them all together. That investment is less than half of what is being put into AI build-out of infrastructure in the US over the last 2 years. Okay? So the scale is absolutely vast. But the challenge is the 2023 problem. And here's the sort of dirty secret in the AI industry that no one talks about. It's called the Habsburg AI problem. Do you remember the Habsburg Empire? Prior to the First World War, one of the largest empires in South Europe, economically military strong, whose leadership was increasingly inbred and unable to take decisions. AI has exactly the same problem. The models may be getting more capable, but the data that they ingest in order to make that reasoning over time get weaker and weaker and weaker. Why? Well, the first generation of AI was trained by harvesting basically all of your data on the internet, as well as everything in Wikipedia, pre-2023 data, which means it was verifiable. Currently, all the major models are ingesting what's known as AI slop, synthetic data. And increasingly, that synthetic data is what trains those models in current affairs. So let me give you an example. New York Times, Washington Post economists prevent AI models from scraping their content. At the same time, the Russian government and the Israeli government has been very smart about creating hundreds of websites that basically reinterpret facts according to their own perspective that is being hoovered up by these models and effectively used to be able to provide their outputs. Why this matters to us is for two reasons, one strategic and one maybe societal. Because there are only two countries that currently operate large-scale language models at scale, China and the United States. This is not just a capture of economic key. This is a cognitive capture. As we become more dependent on these machines to interpret to us facts, the facts that are given to us are the facts that those machines are creating themselves based on the AI slop. That AI cognitive capture or epistemic capture, if you want to use it, is a primary issue that we need to be talking about in AI governance loudly more than anything else. So where's the opportunity? The opportunity, and this is how this ties into intelligence, it's no longer just how good your model is. It's how trusted the data is that you could put into that model. At the end of the day, data, like politics, is local. A model that's trained on unique data that describes agriculture in Saskatchewan will be far more useful to farmers than a model that ingests all the agricultural information in the world, right or wrong. An AI model which is trained uniquely to interpret MRIs is far more useful than a model that gives you a reflection of all the theories of health that you can get on ChatGPT. That's where Canada's advantage is defining where we can create unique data for unique models. Unfortunately, at the moment, Canada, or unfortunately, fortunately, Canada at the moment, is a leader in the three key technologies that are currently driving change globally, this commanding heights. We produce 10% of the world's AI research talent. How much does that get reflected into companies and company value? 0.001%. We are currently leaders in quantum technologies, which we didn't even talk about today, but which would be also important to talk about. We are also leaders in crypto technologies and its application. Do we talk about that in terms of foreign policy? Maybe not. Maybe we should. Thank you.
And I guess I want to end this round because I do want to open it for questions as well. Just on, we've talked about protection of democracy. We've talked about the need for whole of society approaches, but we haven't really talked enough about how to mobilize our public. Is our public really aware of these types of threats? And how do we ensure that there is some immunity, some inoculation, some cognitive forechecking that involves our population? And by way of example, one anecdote I shared with the CBC recently was on a website that appeared during our last federal elections about Canada as a 51st state. And along with the Media Economic Ecosystem Observatory in McGill, we have been doing some tracking of this website, wondering how quickly it had come up in the election cycle and what the origins of it were. And it turned out this website had started off as a real estate exchange website, and it gathered tens of thousands of followers. And then it was sold. It was sold as a shopping channel. And so it was a place where Canadians could share information about what could be bought and sold. And it did this seven times until a group in the United States bought out the website with its tens of thousands of followers and repurposed it as Canada's 51st state, and was accelerated, first of all, by Canadian groups having the same agenda, and then by Russia. And so there's a number, the reason this came to our attention, because there was Canadians who didn't realize that they were associated with this website and were wondering why. But the other issue is that the algorithms know that these people are associated with the website, whether or not they joined it or not. So all those people who would never became aware that they were associated with this website because of its genesis were all of a sudden getting in their feeds, as you do when you look up a vacation plan, all these this news about Canada as a 51st state and the importance of Canada being a 51st state. So that's how nefarious it is. It's not, we're not talking about what is true and what is false. We're talking about you know, manipulation of algorithms and industrialized disinformation. And so my question, and I'll put this to you, Vas, first, is how in this climate, what is it that we need to do with our publics, with the Canadian public, to ensure that first of all, they are literate about this agenda. They are conscious of the threats, and they become part of the solution because they need to be.
Well, I think there's a very dangerous myth that we sometimes perpetuate that our online environments are quote unquote free. All markets have rules. The question is whether they're democratically set and accountable. And when we don't do that, and we, you know, that's a choice as well, private actors set the rules and they set those terms in their favor. And algorithmic curation is, it's very interesting in that a lot of people feel they truly have a sense of capital P power over that system. It's influenced by, you know, what they viewed before, where they go. It feels personalized in a way that isn't spooktacular in a surveillance way, where you don't see, or maybe you're acknowledging the manipulative nature less often. And instead, it feels like it's something that belongs to you, that you almost built, right? You've invested your online exhaust in, you know, what's going to surface a deal for you or a song or a place to go on vacation. So I wonder about, sure, how that work can be sort of done together, but I never like the idea or solution that everyday people are, you know, responsible for this in some way, or if we just, you know, educate harder or do like a really good campaign, we're going to have a kind of awakening. But I agree with you that it's something foundational there. If I can share a super small thing just to forecast, because if you hadn't heard of the Canadian Shield Institute, no worries, though I think that is my job because we're, you know, we're new here. Starting in July on Canada Day, we're the research partner for season two of Stephen Marsh's podcast, Gloves Off. And this season is all about how we win and what else Canada needs to be doing in those policy elements. So the cognitive stuff, tech, interdependencies, you'll hear more and kind of better stuff then. And I feel like this is the perfect audience. I feel like it's a show made for Ambassadors Canada.
And Anne, you've also talked about whole of society approaches. And what does that actually mean in the context of these threats that we're facing and their complexity?
I think all roads lead to capacity building. We need to build capacity at all levels. You know, when I graduated from Queen's Commerce many years ago, before I went into political science, I had a textbook, Lipsy Purvis Steiner. It was fantastic then. A lot of us use that textbook. A lot of the same economic textbooks are still circulating based on a 1950s, 60s economic model. And we need to acknowledge that we have moved from a tangible economy and tangible wealth to intangible wealth. And we need a policy orientation towards that. So I think training, higher education, I think, you know, we are seeing signs that the academy needs reform. You know, university today is probably not going to look like the same thing and designed around the same faculties and departments, etc., maybe even the same number of universities in 15 years time. So let's get ahead of the curve. Let's look at what does autonomy mean? What does Raph mentioned problem solving? Let's identify the problems and let's build curriculum around those problems. And I would also say, lastly, I think we need to think about our economy like a balance sheet. On one side is the revenue, and we have to grow that pie to keep good people here and not have organizations like Meta, Google, Anthropic publicly thank Canada for providing their senior management teams. To do that, we need to boost paychecks. And so to grow that pie, we need to get in the business of value-added productivity, not just the base products going out the borders, but building on those base products. So Build Homes Canada program should not just have to do with lumber and aluminum and steel, which are all terribly important, but also the high efficiency HVAC systems and those designs that the rest of the world needs and wants. So value added productivity. And on the other side of the balance sheet is the affordability question. I was away from Canada for 21 years and I came back, and it's wonderful to be back. Biggest dream of my life. It's a very, very expensive country, even compared to the European countries that I have lived in. And to address affordability, and VAS is a queen in this subject, pro-competition environment, that is what's needed. So we need to give consumers choice. We need to incentivize entrepreneurialism, get behind our SMEs, grow them, have rules. We have to, and I'll finish on this point, we have to buy, partner, and sell. But we need rules around each of those areas so we capture wealth and we support our productivity. And we don't just build the hardware and sell the hardware and get the hardware end of the deals, but we get the software as well and the rich patents and the value-added patents and trade secrets that we want to protect. We all know that, you know, the technology that empowered all four of the main COVID vaccines was founded in a UBC startup lab with a professor and a couple of RAs. We didn't value it. And a big company from Texas came, snapped it up, and made billions a year and is still making more billions because they're now cancer vaccines and other vaccines that use that technology. So I would say those areas, capacity building, value-added productivity, and getting behind both those agenda.
So wrap some rapid fire points before we open it up for a couple of questions.
When President Trump slaps the tariff on autos in Ontario, the plant stays in Ontario. When he slaps tariffs on agricultural goods, the grain is still standing in the fields. If he weaponizes access to digital technologies, this country shuts off overnight because we are 90% dependent on data centers, desktop technologies, and AI infrastructures that sit south of the border. We own two fiber optic cables that connect Canada to the rest of the world, and one of them goes to Greenland. Okay? We are a digitally landlocked country. Digital is everything. Digital sovereignty is everything. Unless we're able to establish that, we don't have an economy that we can grow because this is the foundational part of the global economy going forward. We need to establish that by capitalizing on what we have, which, as Anne said, is both ample human resources as well as R&D, but to translate that into something tangible, building companies. To do that, we need to be protectionist. We need to be aggressive in terms of export. We need to be able to look at markets which maybe aren't the easy markets south of the border that we've been used to, but maybe they're the high-value market where Canadian know-how actually makes a difference. We also need to look at this as a nation-building process. Canada, at the end of the day, was built coast to coast with the railway. Canada will be built for this century coast to coast to coast through a digital infrastructure. Thank you.
So we will, we can open it just for maybe a couple of questions. I'll take a couple together and then just ask.
Juste un moment, s'il vous plaît. Nous allons commencer avec une question en ligne, si vous le permettez. So I have a question online. It's coming from May El-Bouri. When we're talking about data capture, maintaining records and archives to analyze information, what are the best ways to store this information? It seems a lot of big organizations who often are making it more challenging to easily access information are also the ones with the largest, most robust platforms on which to store these records and information.
I mean, I think that's part of why you're seeing this bigger conversation around data localization. But as this room knows, you know, just because data is localized doesn't mean that it isn't subject to U.S. laws like the Cloud Act and FISA. So that's something else that Canada is grappling with when it comes to those infrastructures. And, you know, to Raph's point on our history and our future with digital sovereignty, we're at the wonderful University of Ottawa. I mean, researchers built a kind of intranet internet that is sovereign and secure. That's kind of a really cool model for communications. Canary, right? Like Canary should be having its moment in the sun. Canary should have its own little heritage moment. We've done it before. We can do things like this again, but we can't hold our breath and just hope that these threats are going to go away if there's a new administration in the future. I know that's silly to say to this room because, of course, we accept it, but I find myself almost appreciative, almost relieved, even though it's a very kind of stressful and squeezed situation for Canada, that we're able to have these conversations and do these assessments and these inventories around how are we managing those intangible assets, where have we fallen down before, and how are we going to stand up?
Did you have something to add, or should we take another question?
No, let's go for another question.
It's over here. Just flip it up.
Hello. Oh, perfect. So thank you so much for sharing with us a very interesting, very challenging topic with a lot of opportunities. I will introduce my question, start with kind of the challenge we're seeing every day in the finance, policy, and the program world I'm dealing with every day. So my team is overseeing $118 million investment for housing, infrastructure, and communities. Before 2023, when I review the work from my team members, I can actually trust their work because, like you mentioned about the data where they're using is TBS policy or the references that and data we actually from the government source of data. But after 2023, after AI is introduced and everything, one reviews of products from the team members have to pay particular attention to see certain things, because a lot of the young generation, they don't actually go back to the original source to double check the accuracy of the data anymore. Sometimes they're making the fundamental mistakes, which we will never see that before 2023. So my question is, as Anne mentioned earlier, we're no longer the follower of the rules, but the maker of the rules. How we can making sure the data feeding into all these advanced platform technology things are accurate, trustworthy, and also accessible with the control we wanted to ensure the security moving forward. Thank you.
So I'm also going to take a question at the back of the room. I think that the gentleman standing as the last question, and then I'll ask the panelists to answer those questions and incorporate final thoughts as well.
No.
Thank you.
Technology is problematic on a number of different levels.
My question is related to what you said. Raf, you said earlier when you talk about the big AI companies and models, I actually, you know, have thought about what you said, that AI is now creating information regardless of where it comes from, and then it refeeds into itself, which to me should be very significantly reducing the value of these models, but it doesn't seem to be the case, right? Am I wrong, or they still seem to be, you know, very attractive to investors, et cetera. So I was wondering if you had some thoughts on that, whereby at one point you will have more what I would call closed loop AI systems. My daughter's a lawyer, so if you could have a closed loop AI that takes information from all the pertinent websites or sources of information about law, I think it exists actually, but your thoughts on what the value eventually will become of those big AI's models, which at one point will be 100% corrupted. So I'll leave it at that.
So Raf, why don't you start this round and answer both questions and any final
thoughts? Well, no, I mean, look, I think history teaches us that first movers in the market generally aren't the ones that last for the long time. All of you probably remember when the federal government invested heavily into Wang computers. Remember Wang computers, which were meant to solve word processing? They disappeared, much for the reason that large language models will disappear. And that centralized computing doesn't actually give efficiencies. That's why I said earlier on, small language models, highly curated data sets, that's likely where we're going to see a lot of value. It's going to be the MRI machine that runs an AI that can actually detect tumors that's going to make more value than these large-scale general-purpose technologies. That's not to say that these general-purpose models aren't going to be around for a long time. They will be. The other thing to consider, though, is this is only one model. We've grown used to the fact that Silicon Valley for the last 35 years has created a global public good that people have uncritically accepted as being a global public good, whether that's Microsoft Word, you know, whether that's Oracle, et cetera. That's no longer the case right now. If you talk to a Chinese businessman and you say, show me your AI, they're not going to point to the cloud. They're going to point to a hardware box in the corner. And that's the model of AI that we're seeing now propagate wildly around the world. If you go to Syria right now, Syrians can't access ChatGPT or Anthropic, but they can access dozens of Chinese models that are available for them to run on hardware that they buy from China. That's happening across the developing world. That's the alternative, and that's what mitigates against, you know, this aggregation that we see. For Canada, the advantage, though, and just maybe to sum it up, is this. We didn't talk about quantum, but quantum is a big deal because currently, any encryption that is used to secure any data that we have right now is subject to have being broken by quantum means when those means become available on a commercial scale, which means that the challenge of the root of trust is really the next challenge beyond AI that's going to be fundamental over the next 10, 15 years. Why that matters is for two reasons. Trusted data and creating trusted data will create models that are both trustworthy and usable. That country or that group that is able to master both at the same time will lead far more than just those that are currently moving into AI models. Creating a root of trust also is going to be fundamentally important for any society and any economy to maintain the kind of trust that right now exists cryptographically, but which is subject to breaking by quantum means. So if I was to sort of prognosticate and say, where are we going to be in 10, 15 years? I think we're actually going to see blocks of countries that share a cryptographic root of trust, and that's going to be the new geography within which we operate.
That challenge with quantum, it also includes all the data that China has been collecting, whether it's encrypted or not, for years as part of its social engineering and as part of its probe for the future. So Vass, and then Anne, you get the last word after Vass for the whole session. But Vass, please come in.
Oh, man. I mean, Anne mentioned printing press earlier on, and I think some of, you know, when models are cannibalizing themselves, as we're seeing, I think along that spectrum, we sort of slide away from printing press and we get closer to Beanie Baby. And that speaks to some of the potential, you know, market inflation and bubbling that we're starting to see, right? As at the same time that Canada is doubling down on the adoption of this technology, right? Starbucks, Pizza, they're not using proprietary algorithmic systems anymore because they just didn't work. And you were saying we've accepted big tech in our lives. I mean, for whatever reasons with these models, we've accepted their defectiveness as a feature, right? And not something that as consumers, as purchasers, as businesses, that we're saying is unacceptable. In fact, if anything, we're saying, well, if we just give it more information or train it a bit better or a little bit harder, you know, it'll improve. And that's, I think, an interesting aspect of the geopolitics of this technology, not just for access and localization and export controls and dominance, but also design and reliability and true trust. One of the top ways to earn trust in technology is to have a product that's trustworthy. I'll close by saying never before in history has there been such a presumed strong role for the state to support the adoption of a particular technology. I've taken a look at the historic rates of adoption for different hardwares and softwares, smartphones, personal computers, home phones. What we are assuming will happen with AI is a rate identical to smartphones. And don't forget that pagers and flip phones, because we all had them, predated and normalized that technology. It's super interesting.
And you set us up, so please take it home.
Well, I just want to say that the question in the chat that was read out is a really important question, and actually it stumps a lot of us and many of us, and because I'm an academic and have to learn about these things, I've chased the answers. But we have very underutilized data centers in Canada, and we can house Canadian data. So the problem here is that Canadian data is not secured and harnessed. So we could have the best AI strategy in the world, we could have the best supercomputer in the world, but if our data is not harnessed, all of those developments will be undermined. And so can you imagine, we have uniquely structured health data. We have the information under lock and key of every Canadian's health from birth to death. That is a gold mine for innovations. We have the most diverse multicultural capital of the world in Ontario, Toronto, and it's a provincial capital. So, you know, we could be the center of the universe for clinical trials, biotech, gene therapy, etc. And that's just one sectoral example. But we need to secure our data, and it's nothing more than, you know, leasing space at a data center, putting a rack down if you're a government agency or an organization, and don't renew your contract with Amazon Web Services when it comes up for renewal. Relocate the data feed to that rack in that data center. But it's not just about technical solutions. There is a governance side of the equation, which is really important. And this feeds into Rafa's point. If the data sources are not trusted, then nobody will trust the opportunities that AI could bring. So we need to show our public that the sandbox is Canadian. And we are relocating our data to, harnessed under Canadian lock and key and under Canadian legal frameworks too, which is importantly. Not only Canadians will then trust the AI solutions, but other countries in the world will see Canada, predictable democracy, and say, I want to store my data in those data centers. I want to have it governed under those standards and principles. So bring on that middle power discussion and let's start setting new standards and be rule makers, not rule takers. Thank you, Jennifer.
So I think you managed to leave on an uplifting note. So thank you. Thanks to the panel. Fascinating discussion.